The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main
they
engine
are
start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Friday Morning Space Show. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. We have a very important and very, very timely program for you today. I'm going to skip some of the typical introductory comments to spend more time with our guest. First of all, if you want to call us, and I'll tell you when the toll-free number is opened and available. Right now, it's not available so that our guest can put forth his comments and what we're going to be discussing today. But that toll-free line is 1-866-687-7223. Do remember that there are no call screeners, and be patient. I'll answer the phone as soon as possible, and I'll bring you up on air as soon as possible. I will hold you over breaks, so don't let an upcoming break prevent you from using the toll-free number. And for those of you who still want to use email, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and you can also use dmlivings@yahoo.com. Do remember, we're trademark copyrighted and all of that, so please don't copy the shows and edit them, and don't do anything commercial with the shows. We appreciate your cooperation on that. Otherwise, if you want to send them around to your friends and associates and family members, you certainly have our permission to do that, help get the word out as to why space is so very important. The other thing I guess I want to talk about is our podcast. We are iTunes compatible, Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com, whyastro.com, and the newest edition is Zune, Z-U-N-E, by Microsoft. And then do remember that we're partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for space security, and you can get a lot more information from them by visiting their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And also, we have a new partnership with them, and the Space Show will soon be bringing you webinar panel discussions with guests from not just around the country, but from around the world. So stay tuned to those special programs. We'll have more about that as we gear up, put the technology in place, get everything perfected, and off we go. So you'd have to be living under a rock today to not realize we have a United States as well as world energy mess. And as you will hear later in the program, this mess does apply to space, both people who try to raise money, acquire capital, and who want to spend money on things, maybe space tourism, maybe other things. And it certainly applies to how governments will allocate resources as more and more of expenses, inflation, and things go into areas that are impacted by energy. And energy impacts just about everything that we do, that we eat, that we work with. So our guest today, Dr. Robert Hirsch, is the lead author of a new Apogee book, The Impending World Energy Mess, What It Is and What It Means to You. And he has a foreword in the book by Dr. James Schlesinger, who was our first U.S. Secretary of Energy. Also, Apogee has given me an additional book that I will give away to the first listener who calls in with a comment or question for Dr. Hirsch. You only get it on a telephone call. You don't get it by sending in emails, and I only have one book to give away. Now, I have read the book, and it is, plain speaking, really important, tells it like it is. And for those of you that are interested in this, and I think everybody should be interested in it. I think this book is probably one of the best, if not the best, you can get, because it really puts energy, alternative energy, policy, all of the economics of this in perspective and in a way that you absolutely can understand it. You may not always agree with it, but you will absolutely understand it. So the lead author, Dr. Hirsch, is a senior energy advisor at Management Information Services, a consultant in energy technology and management, and founder of Alumni Gen, a startup company based on his invention for hydrogen production. Previously, he was a senior staff member at SAIC, RAND, and Advanced Power Technologies, vice president of the Electric Power Research Institute, VP and manager for oil and gas upstream research at Atlantic Richfield, founder and CEO of Arco Power Technologies, manager of Exxon Synthetic Fuel Research Lab, manager of petroleum exploratory research at Exxon, assistant administrator of the U.S. Energy Research and Development Administration, and director of fusion research at the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission and IRDA. He has more than 40 years of professional experience in these areas, 15 patents, and over 50 technical publications, and his PhD is in engineering and physics. So it is a real honor to welcome Dr. Robert Hirsch to the Space Show to talk about our energy mess, and we do have an energy mess. And welcome to the Space Show, Dr. Hirsch. How are you today?
I'm doing just fine, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
Talk about timing. You're on talking about the energy mess, and we've got Libya and the Middle East virtually on fire or near on fire, oil included or likely to be included. So from when you wrote the book to today, I would imagine you would say the energy mess has gotten to be a little bit messier. Is that a fair assumption?
Around the edges, definitely so. One of the points that we took in writing the oil portion of our book was geology and geological limitations, and that's something that you can't beat no matter what. On top of that are such issues as politics and governments and what people do, but the fundamentals are geology, and the fundamentals are not a happy story.
So let's start then with the fundamentals. For our listeners, what are the geology fundamentals with petroleum?
It's complicated, and that's why I wrote the book, but let me do the best I can to be as simple as possible. First of all, oil is a finite resource. Nature conspired in various ways over millions and billions of years to create that wonderful stuff that powers, in fact, a great deal of our, almost all of our transportation in the world, and provides us with chemicals and medicines and a whole variety of other things. But it's a finite resource. And what that means is that at some point you're going to reach a maximum in what you can produce, and then production will go into decline. Oil fields, and the world is made up of thousands and thousands of oil fields. Oil fields behave in ways that are different than we're used to in our everyday lives. And very simply described, oil production in an oil field increases after you begin to produce, reaches a maximum, maybe a sharp maximum or a plateau that lasts a number of years, and then oil production goes into a long decline. The same kind of pattern occurs in countries and regions, and the same behavior is expected for the world. So what that basically means is we have increased oil production over a very, very long period of time, 150 years or more. It turns out that recently we've gone on to a plateau. In other words, oil production, while fluctuating, hasn't increased very much at all, and our expectation is that in the relatively near future, 2 to 5 years, oil production will go into decline worldwide, and then we're going to have one mess in energy.
Let me put it this way. Would it make a huge difference to the United States, if we just look at the United States, if we really were embarking on more drilling. We opened up the Gulf again, Alaska, offshore California. What would that do to our future demands for energy? Does it buy us significant time, or is it marginal?
Unfortunately, it's marginal, but there is no simple single answer to working the problem. There are a number of options, and I can tell you if you'd like to go into it.
Sure.
Well, we're going to have to pursue all of them, and one of them is to open up and produce as much oil as we can in the United States.
So, you know, the stumbling block there is, I guess, political, right?
Yes.
So do you have suggestions on how you work the political problem, or is it just you politicians need to understand it, and hopefully they do the right thing?
There's a strong need for politicians to understand a great deal more than they do about energy. As an example, when we talk about oil and its importance, we're talking about, first of all, an enormous volume that we consume every minute, every hour, every day, year, and so forth. People don't really appreciate that. They don't also appreciate how so much of our modern civilization depends on oil, not only for getting to work and but moving goods and operating our farms and flying our airplanes and power our military and so forth. Oil is built into just an enormous amount of activities that our societies are built on today. People don't really appreciate that. One of the things that we try to do in the book was just to provide examples of how oil is basically everywhere. The building that you're in was built in part by oil because construction material had to be brought by gasoline or diesel fuel to the site and then lifted into place by gasoline or diesel-powered equipment and so forth. It is just absolutely amazing how much we depend on liquid fuels. The second point, and one that is so obvious when you dig into it, but seems to not be widely recognized, is the fact that oil is energy, but not all of energy is oil. And that may sound a little bit cute, but people talk about using wind power or solar cells to cure our oil problem, and that simply can't happen in the short term. And the reason for that is that those two renewables and other renewables produce electric power. And your automobiles and trucks and airplanes and farm equipment and trucks and buses, they all operate on liquid fuels. So you'd have to replace large fractions, if not eventually all of those various pieces of equipment with something very different that operates on electricity. And in the short term, wind and solar cells can have essentially no impact at all on the oil problem. And politicians don't seem to understand that. Another issue that unfortunately clouds people's minds, as one of the old radio programs used to say, is that renewables can do everything. Renewables can save us. And in fact, most renewables have serious, serious fundamental problems. I mean, the sun doesn't shine at night, for instance, and we require electric power at night. The wind doesn't always blow, and we require electric power essentially all of the time. People don't understand those differences, and they've idealized renewables as something that would be wonderful. But in fact, they're useful, but they're not everything that people believe. And that all adds up to part of the mess that we're in.
How badly does the great grammar there? How badly does the continued use of fossil fuels impact our environment? Is it as bad as what the media and what politicians say? I mean, you know, the cry is we must move away from fossil fuels as soon as possible. It's ruining the earth. It's ruining the climate. It's this and this and this. And of course, China, you know, it may be paying attention to that in lip service, but they're still building coal fire plants, you know, more rapidly than any place else in the world. So what are the facts about our continued use of fossil fuels and what it does to the planet?
The situation is that every energy source, every one of them, has strengths and weaknesses. And a number of the weaknesses that some of these golden answers seem to have are not recognized by the public. As I said a moment ago, wind and solar cells are in some ways wonderful, except that they can't do what we require. They simply cannot. Nuclear power is clean with respect to the production of CO2 into the atmosphere and so forth, but it produces radioactive waste. Coal is wonderfully cheap and can be burned very, very cleanly, and it's a domestic resource, which is an awfully good thing, but it does produce CO2. The point is that every technology in energy has strengths and weaknesses, and what people are doing is oversimplifying and grasping some things that are new and therefore that we may not know that much about, and many people don't know that much about, and we're damning those things that have been, in fact, keeping us alive and reasonably healthy and growing for, over 150 years.
So what are, you mentioned a few minutes ago, you know, when I asked you about some of the uses of fossil fuels and what it really does to the earth, I mean, what can we do, and what do you think nations should be doing? Or are we inevitably facing the effects of very high priced and limited energy, and you know the fact that it may change our standard of living, our way of life? Is that inevitable?
Yes. When you say change our standard of living and our way of life, I think probably a large fraction of your audience would take that as meaning we have to make some small adjustments. The problem is that when world oil production goes into decline, oftentimes called peak oil, when that happens, liquid fuel prices are going to escalate dramatically. People talk in terms of gasoline at $10 to $15 a gallon, which is more than a minor change in most people's lives. In addition to that, as oil production goes into decline and we scramble to mitigate the problem, there will be growing shortages. And so even if you're able to spend $10 or $15 per gallon, you won't be able, many people won't be able to get the liquid that they need. And if you think about that and work it through, that means that a whole lot of companies, in fact, are going to have a great deal of difficulty, and many of them are likely to go out of business. There are just a whole variety of things will change, and particularly people who live far away from their jobs, assuming that their jobs are not impacted, will have a very difficult time, in fact, getting to work to do what they hope to do to earn a living. There are some adjustments that we can make with telecommuting and other things, and greater energy efficiency longer term will make a big difference, but very few things can have a big impact and happen quickly.
What type of timelines are we facing before, at least in the United States, society reaches the kind of level that you just described?
Very complicated, and there's a lot of data and a lot of information out there, and it took me a number of years to get through it and classify the good data with the outright lies, because there are a number of outright lies in what's going on and what's involved. After working through a lot of that and working with a number of other people around the world, I say that only to impress, try to impress that we've been very thorough about this. We conclude that the decline, the onset, the beginning of the decline of world oil production will happen sometime in the next 2 to 5 years. Unfortunately, what's going on in the Middle East will, I hope, as you do and your listeners do, we hope that all turns out good and democracy spreads and people have greater freedom and so forth. But it could very well also be that the bad guys take over, and what would happen then, in sooner than that 2 to 5 years, is that some unsavory people, in fact, cause us much more difficulty with respect to oil costs and oil prices.
Listeners, I'm opening the toll-free line if you would like to call in and talk to Dr. Robert Hirsch. And again, the first caller does win his book. The toll-free number, again, is 1-866-687-7223. You do have an initial set of email questions coming in. So Tom is in Denver, Colorado, and Tom says, is there anything that just a regular guy can do about all of this? We certainly don't have any access to make policy, so we're subject to whatever the policies are in the country by the politicians, as well as on the global front. Are we totally helpless?
Excellent question. And in fact, in our book, the second to last chapter deals with what people as individuals can do to minimize the damage to themselves and their families, actions that they can take and that can minimize the hurt. In fact, there will be in all of this mess that occurs some opportunities also. And so what we did was to explain what it is we think will happen, how it will happen. We depend a great deal on what actually happened in 1973 and 1979 when we had oil shortages. The chapter goes into what is likely to happen, and that builds up from the book, and says what kinds of things an individual ought to consider doing on his or her own in order to, first of all, protect themselves, and second of all, because there will be some opportunities to maybe even benefit. I hate like hell to talk about benefiting in tragedy, but human history still tells us that, in fact, there are benefits to be had, no matter how awful things might be.
Well, the benefits are the other side of the problem coin, so... whenever you have a problem, you have benefits as well, and vice versa. So I guess that's to be expected. Do we, for people whose businesses, whose activities rely on a strong, healthy economy to acquire capital, or for projects that are funded by the government and they get various grants, or assistance agreements, or you know, whatever it may be, or they require higher than average wealthy people to participate and fund, you know, their business ventures, either through equity or however they may choose to do that. Does this impending energy situation and what it will likely bring economically, does it crowd out wealthy capital, or does wealthy capital, is it so wealthy that it's immune to the kinds of problems that most of us will probably face?
Well, you ask a good question, and it's very difficult to answer. In your question, you use the term crowd out. I doubt that, but by the same token, there's every reason to believe that there will be significant impacts and significant damage to a whole lot of things that people have been doing and are used to doing. It's very hard to extrapolate or forecast into a future that is going to be, as we said, a big mess. People do that, and sometimes they end up being right. More often than not, they're wrong, because there are so many things that will feed back into so many other things. we're talking about business as very unusual, and therefore it becomes very difficult to do any meaningful forecasting. Somebody does a forecast and gets it right, I suspect it'll be a lot associated with luck as opposed to brains, because there just aren't any models available of economies that can take into account not only what happens in the monetary and fiscal world, but how human emotions, which will be a part of what happens in all of this, how human emotions factor in.
Very interesting. So do you think, and we're coming up on our first break, do you think that our leaders understand the full breadth of this? Maybe I can understand why they don't want to tell the people, because they don't want to panic people or you know, send people into a doomsday spiral. But at least in terms of their policy making and their consideration of facts, I mean, they have all these advisors, they have experts, they have staffers that are committed and dedicated to seeking out information, you know, from all perspectives and all sources. Do you think they have a good understanding of where we're headed and what we're probably facing?
There are a number of people in government that have a pretty good idea of the kinds of problems that are flying ahead. Many of those people are not allowed to speak. Some of them, in fact, can speak, but only in private counsel. I think that the government, Congress, and the executive branch are basically either ignorant of or are ignoring the reality. And I prefer ignorant of, because I don't know, I've got a lot of faith in people, I guess. And you have to understand, and we all understand, that people in government, not only at the federal level, but at the state level and the local level, are dealing with some horrendous problems right now, and they've got all they can do to deal with that. And to throw in this additional problem, which will be a major game changer, is to create chaos, and that's one of the reasons why a number of people that maybe might speak up are not speaking up, my view anyway.
The final question before we take our first break, Elaine is in Salt Lake City, and Elaine says, we seldom have the opportunity to hear on the news or read even on credible online news sources or blogs or anything the facts that you're putting forth to us. Is there some kind of rule of thumb as to how we should treat news stories or what we read on the internet regarding the energy? It seems to me that we should discount virtually everything we hear.
Well, you can't discount everything that you hear. There are a whole lot of people that are in the news and communications business that have a narrower rather than a broader insight into a number of these things. And that's not meant as anything other than a reflection of reality. I mean, people concentrate on and think about many of the things that impact them the most themselves. And they, just like I, am ignorant of a number of other things. You've got to listen, it seems to me, going to the literature and going to good resources and understanding what different people are saying helps a great deal to sort through those things that are superficial and those things that are real. And the Internet is wonderful in the sense that just a whole lot of people can express themselves, but a whole lot of people that are expressing themselves only... How does the joke go, the story go? They're feeling just part of the elephant, and they don't really understand the elephant as a whole.
It is wonderful, and they can post whatever they want, and they have no trouble finding like-minded participants or readers, so almost anything goes. So you just have to have a lot of discernment and critical thinking skills brought to the table. Let's take our first break, and we'll be back with more of your listener questions for Dr. Hirsch and more about what he has to say about the impending world energy mess. And again, the toll-free line for those of you who would like to call, and the first person to call gets a copy of the book, 1-866-687-7223. Back in about 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Friday Space Show. Our guest today, Dr. Robert Hirsch, he is the lead author on a very important book that all of you, I hope, will acquire and read, The Impending World Energy Mess, What It Is and What It Means to You. You can buy this book off of the One Giant Leap Foundation Amazon Partners page, and then Amazon contributes some of that purchase price back to the Space Show and its parent One Giant Leap Foundation. So that's a great way to get it, and it's an important book, and I believe that you should do that. Also, a free copy goes to whoever the first caller is, our toll-free line, 1-866-687-7223. And Bob, we have this email question. It's Carrie in Miami, Florida. And he said, many of us see the fact that the high price of fossil fuels, especially gasoline, is needed in order to support bringing online the alternative fuels that we need, green fuels as well as alternative fuels. Also, I'm wondering if your research includes using things that don't exist today, like turning into a hydrogen economy and also finally perfecting fusion reactors. Are those part of the equation and do they help?
Good question. And I spent part of my life in fusion research and fusion research management, so I can speak to that. And we did some studies at the National Academies on a future in hydrogen. And I have high hopes for both areas. The problem is that when oil production goes into decline, there are a relatively limited number of things that we can do. And the key to being successful and catching this problem that will be running away from us will be things that we can implement right away. In other words, coal to liquids, much more drilling, more tar sands production in Canada, gas to liquids in various places in the world, producing much more efficient automobiles and airplanes and trucks and so forth. Those are the kind of things that we can do right away, and what's needed is to do those things very quickly. One of our contributions was a study that was published in 2005 for the Department of Energy that looked at what was the best that we could do with the things that were available. It was a crash program, and your friends that are used to have been involved in the space program understand crash programs. It means going as fast as humanly possible. We looked at a crash program with the things that could make a significant difference. And the problem is that such a crash program, idealized and starting immediately, even though that's essentially impossible, in fact would take much more than a decade to catch up. So the key messages are we have to run with the things that we have right now, and it is going to be much more important to have things that can sustain our lives and some semblance of our modern economies, as opposed to worrying about the last bit of emissions of one sort or another. And I don't mean to downplay or speak negatively about the environment, but when you're starving, having just some water and some food means a lot more than having super clean water and super well-developed food. Yes, there are things for the longer-term future, and there is great hope for hydrogen infusion and other things, but one has to recognize that this problem is going to be so dire that we're going to have to run with those things that are available right away.
So even if we had policy decisions that opened up our offshore and our federal lands, Alaska, for drilling, we're talking about, at best, maybe 3 years to market for hydrocarbons that are found and production facilities are set up. I mean, this doesn't happen overnight, even if the companies have a very, very good idea of where the petroleum deposits are located, correct?
Well, you make a very important point, and that is that to do anything significant in any of these areas requires a number of years, because you have to get, in the case of drilling, you have to get drilling rigs and people to the best places to be able to develop what is hopefully there. It's the same thing with super efficient automobiles. If you decide tomorrow to do it, it is a minimum of 3 years. Even if you have the technologies reasonably ready to go, it's a minimum of 3 years before you can begin to produce and sell those automobiles. If you're going to develop a coal-to-liquids plant, which, by the way, you can do and can be very, very clean in terms of environmental impact, if you're going to do something like that, the best that was ever done in the world was 3 years. That was a crash program in South Africa. What am I saying? I'm saying that when you identify time, it is an extremely important factor. And all of the time that it takes to get these things going, world oil production is in decline, and it's running away from you. And so you have to run like hell to catch up with it.
Let me ask you this, because I know in the discussion that I have with people on this, there, for whatever reason, and I can't really say what the reasons are. I tend to think it's education, but that may be wrong. There is a real inability to separate out our energy needs for electricity in the grid versus transportation. So the electrical side of things with the grid, would it be an okay comment on my part to say that looking into the future, we're less critical on electricity generation? I'm not talking about repairing and modernizing the grid, than we are about what we're facing for transportation?
You're exactly right. The electricity situation, even though it has weaknesses and needs to be upgraded in many ways, is in fact in very good shape. The liquid fuel situation, which is oil, is very different, and it is separable, and people need to understand that these things can't all be lumped together, as we touched on before.
What about cars that are capable of running on natural gas? We do have huge natural gas reserves in the United States. Is that a long-duration process to change out automobiles and get them to be natural gas-fueled rather than gasoline-fueled? And does that help?
It could conceivably help. But let me just tell you what some of the issues are. We can't do it overnight because almost all the cars on the road are not set up to be fueled by natural gas. The other thing that we all know is that there is not a natural gas distribution system out there. So if you had a car that was capable of burning natural gas, you could refuel it. If you have a natural gas-fueled vehicle now, in a few cases there are industrial sites where you can refuel, but that's only for those fleets. You can also buy something to put into your home that can fuel your car from natural gas that's coming into your home. The point is you can't do it overnight. It can be sped up, you can do things faster, and it may be a good answer. The problem that I have is that this new natural gas that we're so excited about, and I'm excited about it also, in fact has a number of environmental problems that are associated with it. And you may have seen, your listeners may have seen, some of the shows that, in fact, talk about people's water wells being damaged and poisoned and their water supply catching on fire and so forth. It is not clear to me, even though I've been looking at this for some time, how all of that's going to turn out. And we better not go to natural gas unless we're very sure that in the United States we have a resource that we can safely and reasonably develop. I hope that's the case, but right now I think the jury is still out, and we'd be foolish to jump to something without understanding it. In fact, we've jumped at a number of things without understanding them in the past, and it's turned out to be dead wrong. And there I talk about jumping into wind without recognizing its limitations, jumping into solar cells without understanding the obvious thing that the sun doesn't shine at night, and jumping into corn ethanol, which in fact is got serious environmental issues associated with it, and from an energy standpoint is an energy loser. So jumping into things without doing your homework is just not a good thing to do.
What about the type of ethanol used in Brazil that comes from not from corn, but from other types of crops that are grown?
Good question, and it turns out that Brazil is unique in the sense that you can grow sugarcane down there because the conditions are just right for its growth and its harvesting. And ethanol in Brazil from sugarcane turns out to be a winner.
Can we import it?
We could import it, but the politics in this country have put a very large tariff on imported ethanol, and so it's not happening to a significant degree.
And that's part of the subsidy for the corn in the agricultural industry, correct?
Seems to be. The other thing is you have to keep in mind that Brazil is producing a great deal of ethanol, but they're also consuming it. They export some. If they were able to export much more, it might be useful, but it would certainly not solve our problem.
And can we don't grow sugarcane, obviously, but can we grow something similar that would work like sugarcane rather than making ethanol out of corn?
Well, the answer to that is if the answer was yes, then we'd be doing it. And we're not doing it, therefore the answer is no.
And all of these efforts that I read about and hear about, making fuel from garbage and biologicals and other things like that, I know there's a lot of efforts going on. I know that in and around NASA Ames, there are companies that are working on making fuel from all sorts of different biological and sort of garbage-like materials. How does that enter into the situation?
Well, a number of those things, in fact, can be useful, and they're also useful from the point of view of other things, because we have a lot of garbage to deal with, and if we can take something that we're going to throw away anyway and make something useful out of it, that's got to be a good thing. But particularly since it cuts down on the amount of waste that we have to get rid of. The problem is that things like that, while useful and people can make money in doing that kind of a thing, and you can improve the local environment by doing that kind of a thing, there's not enough there to make a big dent on the problem that's ahead of us.
You have a question from Karen in Seattle. And again, listeners, let me give out the phone line because, you know, we're pushing for users to use the phone line in this year. 1-866-687-7223. So Karen in Seattle says, are there any European or other countries that have adopted a so-called green economy where it is working for them and we can model what they're doing? We hear all the time about how green this and green that has advantages, gets government subsidies, and in many ways is absolutely favored. What is the facts about European green economies? I know, for example, Spain has very actively pursued a green economy. Has it helped their energy situation?
Well, are there things out there that we could model after? And the answer, at least from my knowledge, is no. A number of people have jumped into green technologies, which, by the way, require huge subsidies, which tells you something about their natural marketability. People have jumped into things like that, and they're cutting back. Spain is cutting back dramatically on its green subsidies because it simply can't afford it. We're subsidizing in this country to a significant degree, but as we all are painfully aware, we've got serious financial problems, and cutting back on a number of these subsidies, in fact, is something that we're going to have to do. I don't know of anything out there to look to and say, they've done it well, and we could copy them and benefit accordingly.
Todd in San Diego, who always emails us and never calls, hear that, Todd? Todd says, can there be any way to go after coal or the oil shales that are throughout the West and use them as liquid fuels for transportation?
The answer to that is yes. One of the things that we looked at in our 2005 study for the Department of Energy was coal to liquids. As it turns out, I've had some direct experience in coal liquefaction. We know it works. We know it can be done in a very clean way, except that there will be production of carbon dioxide. We know how to do that. The South Africans have been doing it for decades, and it can successfully be done. Oil shale, we have an enormous amount of this rock in Colorado and Utah that contains a hydrocarbon called kerogen that is kind of oil-like. And we know we can get that kerogen out, and we can refine it into very clean products. The problem with that technology is it's not yet commercial. I expect that it will be within certainly the next decade, maybe within the next 5 years. There's some very clever people doing some very clever things. But it's not ready now. And what we need is things that are ready now in order to be able to expand them. So yes, there will be other things like that, like oil shale in the future, that can make a difference.
Your best guess, will public policy allow us to pursue these technologies, or because there's carbon production or this or that, they use a lot of water or whatever it may be, will they be politically untenable?
Well, there's a number of things that I think your listeners and you certainly understand right now are politically very difficult, if not untenable. And that's because people have frightened the hell out of us. Can I say that on radio?
Yeah, well, this is internet radio. You can say worse if you would like. We just don't do any name-calling or character assassination.
I totally agree with that.
We try to be civil.
People have scared the public a great deal about climate change and a variety of other ills. And They've done that by looking narrowly at incomplete science. And if anybody tells you the science is complete, then they really don't know what they're talking about. They've scared people. There are people in Washington who are frightened, and they see the politics of this. It won't be until a large part of the population is hurting very badly that we're going to get pragmatic and say, we've got to have liquid fuels, and we've got to not only save them, but we've got to produce them in order to keep our economy going, because otherwise we will die.
Okay, so here is another question. Alice is in Chicago. And again, listeners, use the phone. Boy, I keep pushing it. I'm telling you, the techie audience is email and chat. Okay, so Alice says in Chicago, so you keep talking about the use of liquid fuels. So, you know, my question is, if we need liquid fuels, can't we back out of liquid fuels some components of transportation and do other things to propel it? For example, and I know you'll probably say it's not ready now, but I saw the National Space Society space solar power study of a few years ago, and the military in that study talked about using beamed space solar power to back out energy for some of their transportation convoys and to be able to have batteries and beam energy to people to replace some of the need for liquid fuel. Are we not at all close to anything like that? The space solar power community thinks that they could do commercial space solar power right now if they only had the funds to develop it.
Well, it's a good question. It's a very intelligent question. As it turns out, a number of decades ago, I had responsibility for the federal program that did research and development on renewables, including what was called space power systems. And I remember there was a fellow named Peter Glazer that pushed that, and maybe some of your older listeners might remember some of that. In principle, it's an interesting idea. The economics are very bad. Maybe they'll get better. Hopefully they'll get better at some time into the future. But basically what you're doing with space power systems, if they can work something like what is envisioned now, is producing electric power. And that electric power can't be used in existing cars and trucks and airplanes and so forth. And so one has to be very careful and differentiate between not only liquid fuels and electricity, which are very different now and will stay different for and won't be substitutable for a long time until we build new equipment. And we also have to pay attention to the economics and the economics of space nuclear power. While it's very interesting and it has a lot of promise, just looks like it is out of sight. In terms of cost.
So, you know, when I have the space solar power people on the program, what they say is as energy costs rise, and I refute this all the time, as energy costs rise, space solar power becomes economic. So in many ways, they have an incentive to see our fuels rise in price because that then brings space solar power into the economic range. And what I say is as these costs rise, so will the cost of developing and launching and running and managing space solar power, and they will never catch up with each other. Any thoughts on that? Because I don't think rising energy prices really make alternative fuels cost-effective because you can never catch up. They're going to go up in price as well, because they require labor and property and management and energy to create the alternative fuels.
I think you said it very well. What happens as energy prices go up is that the prices of everything else goes up. And you said that, and you said it very well. The only place where I might differ with you, David, is with respect to never. Never is too long a time.
Too harsh a word, okay.
So, in the near term would be preferable, but you're exactly right, and I think you're talking exactly about the right principles that come to play.
You have a question from Stephen, who is in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Then Stephen's email question is, another problem with natural gas is that while large distribution systems have been established both in the United States and Canada, most of this infrastructure is old and not being well maintained, especially in residential areas, which cannot be monitored very well using current technology. Look at all the recent pipeline explosions, and the one just south of San Francisco a couple of months ago with PG&E comes to mind, and I read the local press about that, and they were really clueless. And then also you get into the incompetence level and how they don't pursue things and all of that. But that's just human nature. I mean, I don't think you can really say PG&E is any worse than anybody else. This is just what happens. And then he goes on to say, have you factored in the need to upgrade old existing infrastructure into economic models?
First of all, you've got to be very careful about economic models, because economic models in a situation like this that is as complicated as it is, I have not seen anybody's economic model that comes even close to being useful and realistic. Okay, but your listener in Canada should be thankful that he lives in Canada, because they have this enormous tar sands resource up there, which they're producing now, and they can produce at a greater and greater levels in the future. And so from the point of view of national well-being, Canada, in fact, is in much, much better shape than we are. They will be an oil exporter, unless they do something politically. They will be an oil exporter, and thank God they're close to us and we're good friends, and they'll continue to export to us, because we're going to need what they can produce, every bit that they can spare in that regard. As far as the fundamental question about the well-being of pipelines and so forth, the listener makes a very good point. There's a lot that is old, and in fact, in some cases, a number of those pipelines are lost. They don't even know where they are, because old records show that we don't know what's what and where. There will be accidents, unfortunately, and I wish that was not the case, but there will be, but those accidents will be relatively few and far between. And as we upgrade, hopefully we'll take care of a number of these weak links that exist now.
Listeners, we're going to take our next break and come back with our final segment. Again, the toll-free line for those of you asking questions, if you want a copy of the book, 866-687-7223. And we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Friday Space Show. Our guest today is the lead author of the book, the Apogee book, The Impending World Energy Mess, What It Is and What It Means to You. We're talking with Dr. Robert Hirsch. Toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. One book to give away to the first caller. Your question on email again is Perry in Atlanta. And he said, in the last segment, Doctor, you were talking about the differences between the electrical grid and the need for liquid fuel for transportation. However, more and more cars are either hybrids or are electric, running off of electricity. Clearly, as electric cars grow in popularity, we're going to be able to need to generate far more electricity than what we do today. So being able to bring electricity into the grid is very important, and how we should do that through nuclear or solar power or something probably remains a question. Do you think that the electric cars can start to make a meaningful dent in the liquid fuel transportation segment?
Very good question. As it turns out, I was involved in some National Academy of Sciences studies on these issues, and I consider that electric vehicles are very promising. From a personal standpoint, because of my concerns about the impending oil problem, I traded in my own SUV, which I really did enjoy, and I drive a Prius now. So I guess I put my money where my mouth is.
Well, of course, that's a hybrid, not a plug-in electric car.
It's a hybrid, but it's a good little car. I really enjoy it. The plug-in hybrids and the all-electric vehicles are in the process of coming into the marketplace. The problem is that under the very best of conditions, even with significant subsidies, in order to make a significant dent in overall U.S. Gasoline consumption, it takes decades of very rapid development and deployment, sales of these vehicles, in order to make a very big difference. So again, it's a matter of how fast you can do it. The other thing that we talk about in the book, and that's inherent to what's coming, is unfortunately we're talking about a deepening recession. And what a deepening recession means, among other things, is that there will be fewer and fewer people that have the money to be able to buy these much more fuel-efficient vehicles. And so that ends up being very, very complicated. We tried to be optimistic about that kind of a thing, but under the best of conditions, it's going to take time, and with recession, we won't have the best of conditions. Good direction to go. We ought to be going those directions and so forth. Longer term, they're going to make a difference. But this whole thing is a matter of how fast we can do things.
Does methane play a role in anything, either for energy or obviously it's one of the greenhouse gases? Does it play a role in that sense that we need to be careful about, or can we use it for fuel? I know that at one point there was a PG&E experiment going on, and I don't know the status of it, near Bakersfield and in the Fresno area for the over-the-cow manure things from the beef yards, from the cow yards, to try to convert it into energy and then to put it into the PG&E system. I don't know what the progress is on that or if they're still working toward that.
Well, there's a number of ways of addressing the question. Manure and other agricultural waste that produce methane are indeed a source of methane, but it's usually fairly expensive to capture that and be able to use it. Is that useful from an environmental standpoint? In many cases, I think it is worthwhile to do if it can be done in an affordable and reasonable way. So that's a separate question. But in terms of wastes, there is not enough in the waste piles, even though they can be huge, to make a difference in terms of displacing liquid fuels. With respect to powering vehicles with natural gas, which is what methane is, there are in many cities taxis and buses that run on methane, on natural gas, and oftentimes you can see a proud sign on the side of those vehicles. So it can be done, and the good news also is what you need to do is to put tanks into your existing automobile or your existing bus, do a little bit of adjustment of the internal combustion engine, and by golly, you've got something that works. The problem is, where do you get the methane? And you need, for it to happen on a broad scale, you'd have to have a whole distribution of methane or natural gas. And again, you don't do that unless you feel that we've got a big domestic resource. Because if the domestic resource isn't real or is impractical for some reason, then you're going to be importing natural gas from other places in the world, which gets you into the same kind of problems of oil imports. So I'd love to give a short, simple answer, but we thought about a whole variety of these things and actually looked into them, and they're doable, but they can't be done overnight, unfortunately. However, if you as an individual want to buy a methane tank to put into your automobile and you have a home that is served by natural gas, you can buy a system to put into your garage so you can fuel your vehicle. And by golly, you're not going to have problems with gasoline prices and you're not going to have gasoline availability problems. So, again, that's something to think about on a personal scale.
You know, if you could get a building code approval to probably do that in your garage.
I have a friend who deals with these oil issues, and he's had natural gas vehicles for, I think, something like a decade. He had an old Jeep modified, and he's got a Honda Civic that he modified and so forth, and he's got a filler in his a filling device in his garage, and he didn't indicate any terrible problem. I asked him when we were taking a trip together. I asked him, I said, what happens when you run out of natural gas in your compressed tank? He says, I do two things. He says, I call the truck to haul the car away, and I call my wife to come and pick me up.
So that's worth considering. I mean, I have natural gas here. Of course, everything is expensive with PG&E, but it is available, and that might be a better issue than the gasoline that may not be available down the road. Well, we are really in a pickle, aren't we?
Yes. It would be wonderful. It would be wonderful if there was some simple answer to all of this business. But it's really complicated, number one, and that pushes aside all the environmental issues that, in fact, we're going to have to face differently than we've been facing in the past. And then there's the industrial issues of scaling up to do a number of these things. And then there are the policy issues that are going to have to be addressed by the federal and the state and local governments and so forth. And then there's the technologies. And fortunately, there's technologies to save and there's technologies to produce alternate liquid fuels. And as you point out, we can continue to drill offshore and do much better than we've been doing. The problem is that the scale is so enormous that these things can't happen quickly.
Okay, so here's a reality check for listeners based on my little unscientific experience around here in the San Francisco Bay Area. So, number one, the recession is deepening. There isn't any doubt about that with housing prices, unemployment, all sorts of things. Environmental and green movements are on the rise. I met a young kid last week who was at the Cheesecake Factory, and we started talking to him. And he was a student in graduate school at Berkeley, and he was studying green economics. That was his course and department description for the program that he was in, green economics. We have really strong building code and political issues in doing a lot of things in the Bay Area because communities and towns are hyperactive in the environmental and in these other areas. So when you add it all together, I'm not sure we're heading in a direction that really understands the kind of world that is unfolding all around us, whether we like it or not, or whether we have blinders on or not, because it's unfolding. You know, all you have to do is look at what's happening in Libya, for example, to get a clue, or read The Economist and see what's happening to the Spanish economy, that for every one of their green jobs, they lost two regular jobs, and they're trying to back out of it. It just seems to me that somehow the message, the facts, the realistic assessments are not being made across this country. And, to go try and talk, like if I wanted to give a talk, or I bet if I proposed you to go over to Berkeley and talk to one of their green economic classes on energy, I'll bet you wouldn't even get in the front door. So I don't know what the solution is, but I think we're in a situation where we're headed toward desirable political agendas by whoever happens to be in power, and that sort of doesn't take into effect reality. And a lot of people are led to believe whatever the agenda is and whatever the media tells them, and I don't know. I just see things, at least on the short term, as being pretty bleak. And maybe I'm skewed, Bob, by being in the San Francisco Bay Area. Maybe it's not the same in other parts of the country. But it's very worrisome to me. And when I think of the space community and the companies that need to attract investment capital and need to have customers willing to come up to the table and pay $100,000 or $200,000 or $1 million for this or that kind of service or product or access, will they even have those monies? Will their needs be changed as they're, you know, dealing with higher and higher energy prices and maybe down the road some scarcities. Any comments?
Well, you do live in a very green and environmentally conscious part of the country. And you're right, there are a number of people who won't even let you in to talk, which, by the way, is very sad commentary on human existence when we won't even listen to somebody who has a different story. That says that we're probably pretty narrow-minded, and there may be some other negatives associated with that. That is a real problem, and part of the reason that the title of our book says mess in it. I don't like the word mess. I mean, it's just not very elegant at all.
But it's descriptive.
But that's the point. It's a mess because we're going to have to change our thinking. And a whole lot of these people that want a better world, and by the way, I include myself in that sort of a thing, when they find that they are without a job and without a place to live and having to stand in line for soup and food and so forth, their attitudes are going to change, and they are going to demand that their governments change also. It's going to hurt. It's going to hurt badly, and minds will change because they have to.
Last week, a friend of mine who is a Cal alumni, that's, for those of you who don't know, University of California, Berkeley, got one of their newsletters. And they were touting a new study that was released from a Cal research associate, who had gotten federal funding for his paper. And this paper was about how to convince more people to believe in global warming. And he recommended and showed the results of experiments he had done that when he talked to people in public about global warming, he made sure that the temperature in the room was turned up. That is, the heat was turned up so that they were uncomfortably warm, and then they could make an easier connection to global warming. And that was what his federally funded paper was about. And Berkeley was sending this out to their alumni list as a great accomplishment and a great reviewed paper that was now available in the literature. So you can think what you want about that, listeners, but you know that is the kind of situation we're all sort of facing, and our tax dollars funded that research. And I'm sure many of you have other stories that you can tell that are, you know, of the same genre. That does not serve us for going into the future.
Well, there's, again, to use an inelegant word, there's a lot of crap around, and there's a lot of crap that gets funded by the federal government. And there's a whole lot of things like that that can be cut out in order to get our governments back on a more reasonable financial footing. I probably offended somebody, but I frankly don't care because that's what I believe.
Well, and the what we're all facing is going to be very challenging at least. Do you think the United States is better positioned to weather this storm than most countries? I know you said Canada was well positioned to weather this storm. How do you think the U.S. is going to handle this versus other industrialized and developing countries, and including China? And I read somewhere in the last day or so that the U.S. is about to become the world's third economy rather than the first economy. So, we are dropping in all sorts of ways of measuring economic growth and potential and wealth. So how are we positioned versus other nations?
We're in trouble. Canada is much better off. They've got a stable government. They've got an awful lot of good people up there. They've got a huge resource of liquid fuels, and they're going to make money off of that. And hopefully they'll be making money from the United States, because hopefully we'll get a good deal of what it is they have to produce. But we're in trouble. Russia, on the other hand, has got very significant oil reserves yet to be tapped. They're the biggest exporter in the world. You can argue about the desirability of their government and so forth, but from a natural resource standpoint, they are going to be in much better shape than we are. Saudi Arabia, they've got a lot of oil. That's good. By the same token, none of us at this point can say how things are going to turn out with respect to the revolutions that are occurring all over that part of the world. You can look at other countries in similar ways. If you get down to China, they seem to have understood this impending peak of world oil production a number of years ago, and they have made a number of investments around the world to help to secure their well-being into the future. They're an oil importer now, but they've put together some very, very strong alliances. Beyond that, Europe, of course, is in terrible trouble because they have limited natural resources and they've got money problems in addition to that.
Probably this will be the last question. Mary is in Las Vegas, Nevada, and Mary says, what are the probability statistics of discovering huge new oil fields, either in the United States or friendly nations?
In the United States, the chances are very small. And the problem is that giant oil fields, and there have been some discovered in the world, In fact, when you look at how much oil they actually produce under the best of times, they're very important, but it's not huge amounts. In other words, giant doesn't mean giant production on a world scale. We have a much better idea of what the world oil endowment is now because of our geological models and the fact that we've drilled a lot of holes around the world and so forth, and so we have something called well control. There will be a few more giant fields found. There always will be some, but they won't make a huge difference, and that's part of the reason we're in the pickle we're in.
And going nuclear doesn't help on the liquid side at all, does it?
Longer-term electric power, whether it be from nuclear or solar or wind or whatever have you, will make a big difference, but we'll have to change all kinds of equipment, which means cars and trucks and other things, to be able to operate on electric power. And that won't happen quickly because it's expensive and it's time-consuming. And in addition to that, nobody has a way to operate airplanes on electric power. So we've got major technology problems ahead of ourselves.
For listeners who will hear this program when it goes on to the archives and the podcasting later today, do you put out a contact information? Does the book have a website? Is there a way they can get more information from you or ask you questions?
I don't,
I can filter questions for you, which I do for a lot of guests.
If you want to send me some questions, I'll give it my best shot at providing some answers. Apogee Books has a website that covers a number of these issues, and I'm not trying to peddle books, but if the book were to sell wildly and wonderfully, I think maybe I might make minimum wage for the time I put in on that book. I did it because I wanted people to understand. So go take a look at the book. It's not going to put much money in my pocket at all.
And listeners, if you really want to make a difference, you ought to buy copies of this book and donate it to your local high school and community college and other libraries so that students have an opportunity to get a different perspective from what they're probably being taught in their classes, in their science classes, economics classes, political policy classes. I think it might make a big difference, and I don't know if the libraries, I don't know how they acquire books, or what their priority is, but you might donate it to their libraries to help get some different perspectives in front of students and people who will be making these important policy decisions in the future, because you and I are probably not going to be doing it. Pearls of Wisdom, how would you like to leave it with listeners today, or takeaways from the mess that we're facing?
I'd say pay attention. Recognize it's a real issue. It's very distasteful, but don't let distasteful things keep you from taking a very hard look and understanding and protecting yourself, and then hopefully in some ways benefiting. But for sure, please do the best you can to influence the political process also.
Thank you very much. And it's a very big, important issue and an eye-opening issue. And again, listeners, if you don't think it's connected to our favorite subject of space development, you're making a big mistake. It is. So I would urge all of you to pay attention and to learn what Dr. Hirsch is talking about and what we've just barely covered on this show today. Bob, thank you very much for being on the program. Do you have another book in mind on a similar or related topic?
For the time being, I'm written out. And, I tried to pour everything that we know from decades of experience into that book. So,
well, it is exceptional. And not only do I thank you for being on the space show, but for helping get real information in front of us, something that is very, very badly needed in our country. And again, I hope many, many listeners tap into it and learn from it as I have. So thank you again for being on the space show, and I hope to be in touch with you in the future, and maybe we'll do some updates depending on how the mess evolves and the timeliness of the evolving mess that we're facing. And again, thanks again for being a guest on the space show today.
My pleasure.
Listeners, that's it. Rob Godwin, who does have Apogee Books, is on Sunday with a couple of George Griffith republished science fiction books. You'll enjoy that show too. Thank you all for being part of the space show today, and thanks again to Dr. Robert Hirsch for his fine book and for his participation as a guest. Goodbye, everybody.